This episode is sponsored by More Than a Number, the brand new podcast from ICAEW. Search for More Than a Number in your podcast app to hear Louise Cooper and thought leaders unpacking the numbers behind some of the most pertinent questions of our time.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Katie Balls. So it's only a couple of days before the EU Council was supposed to meet where they were supposed to be hammering out a Brexit deal. James, where are we at with the Brexit negotiations?
Well, we'll already know more in our midnight podcast because Michel Barnier has set a deadline of midnight Brussels time or Luxembourg time, so 11 p.m. our time for progress. So I think while there is still some progress being made, I think there is a little bit less optimism as right of this moment, which is 12:01 or something, when there has been previously. I think the EU are basically trying to use the time pressure to say, right, if you want this deal, you need to sign up to more concessions on this, more concessions on that. I mean, that is making things harder. Boris Johnson met the DUP last night, and there are obviously limits to how much further he can go on the Northern Ireland only aspect of things without upsetting them. And then don't forget this whole issue of level playing field requirements. One of the things that makes a deal between on the Irish border simpler is the idea that UK-EU trade after Brexit would be tariff-free and quota-free. That was in the Theresa May political declaration. But lots of people on the EU side are very keen to say that was in the Theresa May political declaration because it was clear that she was committed to all sorts of level playing field provisions. Boris Johnson doesn't want to make those same commitments because he and, just importantly, a lot of people on the more Eurosceptic wing of the Tory party feel that making those commitments kind of slightly nullifies the point of Brexit. If the UK can't make its own decisions about what it wants to do on social and environmental and all that stuff, then, you know, that limits the utility of Brexit. So I think that is those are two potential trip areas before there's a deal tonight. I think this is going to, these circles are very hard to square. They're not impossible to square, but it's going to take a large dose of political will and legal creativity to do that. Whether that can be done before midnight tonight or not is, I think, far from certain. Sorry, I just said it was 12:01, and it's actually, I see from Katie Ball's pointing at a clock, 1:15.
So, Katie, what is it that Boris Johnson is still talking to the EU about? I mean, there are rumours that the EU has already rejected this dual system customs partnership idea, as well as completely rejected a sort of Stormont lock. I mean, can Boris Johnson have a better deal on any of those things?
So, as James says, a lot of this is about the future political declaration, and some of that comes into level playing fields. But specifically in terms of what is the arrangement for Northern Ireland? Is it something very close to the Northern Ireland only backstop, or is it something different? And you hear about the new customs partnership. Now, I understand one of the things is this idea that Northern Ireland technically leaves the customs union, but there you would have every good that entered Northern Ireland would be presumed to be under the tariff scheme of Republic of Ireland and the EU, and then you could claim a rebate later. Well, some on the UK side don't like that. Mm. They think that's too much to give. So they would like, if when goods came in, there were two different channels they would go through, rather than everything being presumed to be in that. So I think that it starts to get into more technical customs arrangements than perhaps I intended when I first went into political journalism. But I think it's coming down to specifics like that. And it's those type of areas which I think are what is fundamental in terms of whether the DUP backs this or not, comes down to these things which ultimately say, where is the power? And is the presumption in terms of Northern Ireland being close to this line with the UK, or that Northern Ireland feels as though it is much closer to the EU, even if later they can do this paperwork. And I think it becomes down to this type of balance. Now, things like the consent mechanism are, I almost feel that the biggest issue here is customs, and then you go from there. But again, part of the problem is that you can have a degree of fudge when you're talking about things, particularly when you're talking about things in idyllic scenery in a Cheshire property, as Boris Johnson and Leo Varadkar did. The problem is when you try and make it into a legal text, if you try and make this into something operable, you no longer can have this thing where both sides are almost reading what they want. And I think that's where we're getting to here. I still think that one other thing we're hearing, you know, is maybe this isn't the EU Council summit that will do it. There might be a second EU Council summit. That's an idea that's being floated by various EU figures. I think it might be to put more pressure on Boris Johnson, because ultimately Boris Johnson is supposed to request an extension by this Saturday if a deal hasn't been agreed. So you can talk about having a second EU council meeting perhaps in a week's time. That's not particularly helpful to Boris Johnson because he still has to find a way to circumnavigate, to get around the Hillary Benn legislation.
I mean, there is one other thing which worth noting which could be helpful to Boris Johnson is various commissioners, including most notably the French choice, have been knocked back by the European Parliament. So there's going to be a month-long delay before this new European Commission takes office, the 1st of December. If this extension the EU granted was only to the end of the Juncker Commission's term, so essentially taking you up to the 1st of December, that would obviously not allow time for a second referendum and would very much be purely, we'll try and get a deal at the end of the month and then give you a month or so to push it through your parliament at speed. I wonder if that could be kind of more palatable than a longer extension. I still think that one of the things that makes the situation so dynamic is if the differences between the two sides, they might be small by the end of this process, but there is a chance that they could be small but unbridgeable. And then the question is, what does Boris Johnson choose to do to try and make them bridgeable? And do we have a total flip back to, right, let's fight an election and try and use it and use that to break the logjam? I'm not saying that's his likely. I'm just saying that but the situation is remarkably fluid right now, partly for the reasons that Katie said about the extension, and also partly because you might be close, but that final few inches might be impossible to bridge within the current parliamentary dynamics.
But James, why would the EU give an extension anything other than January 31st, which is stipulated by the Benn Act? Because anything else they'd have to pass through Parliament, so surely it's just adding more uncertainty.
Well, from the EU's point of view, right, they don't have to say that this is the last extension. Every time they grant an extension, right, they have the ticking clock working in their favour.
I see.
That's not necessary. I don't think the EU wants this to go on forever. But if you granted a short extension until then, again, that would basically say to Boris Johnson, what are you going to do? Because you'll have to come back here and your parliament will undoubtedly pass another version of the Benn Act saying that if there isn't a deal by the 30th of November, you'll have to go back and request another extension. So I think in some ways you can see how a short extension could work for the EU. And I also do think that the EU would genuinely very much like to, not at any cost, but very much like to have this resolved before the new commission comes in place.
Katie, it's also been the SNP's annual conference in Aberdeen this week. How's that been going for them?
Well, perhaps unsurprisingly, Scottish independence has been top of the agenda, and that's something you hear repeatedly. I think what's interesting is how Nicola Sturgeon is pitching Scottish independence. So she's now saying that Scotland would be perfectly poised to actually almost act as a bridge, something Boris Johnson likes to build, between the EU and, well, what would remain of the UK if Scotland was independent, because Scotland would remain in the EU or would rejoin the EU, depending on what's happening. I think rejoining gets a bit trickier for Nicola Sturgeon. But Scotland would be an independent country, but in the EU. And therefore, you would have almost an easy way to pitch Scotland as somewhere you would have access to both markets. This idea that even if there was a hard border, something not really getting into between Scotland and England, you would still have that market on your doorstep too. So it's interesting how she is ultimately trying to use the current Brexit landscape to boost the case for Scottish independence. I think the other thing that you can see from what she's saying is she's trying to make this picture, at least, that the Scottish government is one that works together, the one that actually functions, one that can do things. And she's keeping trying to make almost this contrast between what's happening in Westminster and what's happening in Scotland, saying her government can actually achieve legislation, it can do things. I think that she's probably being helped slightly by the fact we just had a Queen's speech that no one expects to pass. But I think those are the two messages coming from her. This idea, I'm not going to use strong and stable, though I have said it, of the Theresa May campaign, but trying to pitch the Scottish government as far from the chaos of Westminster, and secondly saying that Scotland can actually take an advantage from the Brexit situation for independence.
And James, has that been quite successful for them so far? I mean, over the weekend there was a Sunday Times poll that showed support for Scottish independence is now up to 50%.
I think that there are two things that have helped the SNP. One is Westminster, as Katie has said, has looked dysfunctional these past few years. It's hard that anyone could look at the scenes we've seen and think, oh, perfect functioning political union.
Mother of Parliament.
And the second thing is obviously Scotland voted to remain, and there's a feeling that, you know, that Scotland is leaving the EU against its will and all this. I still think that if once Brexit actually happens, it massively complicates the SNP case for independence. There is a reason that the SNP, which used to be a fairly Eurosceptic party, decided to advance its argument for independence in Europe. It made everything a lot simpler. If you go back to 2014, Alex Salmond's big answer to every question is, well, there wouldn't be any trade friction at the border because Scotland and our UK would all be in the EU and therefore in the same single market and the same customs union. If the UK leaves the EU single market and the customs union, there would have to be, as the Irish example is showing us, there would have to be some kind of border between Scotland and the rest of the UK. And given how much more Scotland exports to the rest of the UK than it does to the EU, that would have a big knock-on effect. I think one of the other things about that Brexit makes more difficult about the case for independence was, in 2014, Alex Salmond always talked about how, you know, these divorce negotiations would be cordial, they would be very smooth. If it is as difficult as it is proving to be to break up a 40-year economic union with some political aspects, how much harder would it be to break up a 300-year political union that covers everything from politics, the economy, the military, diplomacy? You know, how would you do all that? That would be so complex. And I don't think these divorce negotiations between the UK and the EU can leave anyone with any doubt that they would be acrimonious, that these would not be a smooth path. You know, they would be a brutal negotiation as both sides trying to exert as much advantage as they could.
So not an amicable breakup. And Katie, finally, you report that today there's going to be a cabinet minister meeting, but not the cabinet. What is it going to be doing?
Yes, so the cabinet committee, which is a select number of ministers that have been invited to... So just pausing as Fraser comes in to eat my lunch. So the select number of ministers who've been invited on the cabinet manifesto committee are meeting for the first time today. And that's the first meeting talking about what's going to be in the Tory manifesto if there is an election at any point, perhaps next year. The manifesto is being written by Muneera Mirza, who's the head of policy at Number 10. Rachel Wolfe is also contributing. But these ministers are giving consultation and they're being told to feed in ideas. So they're all coming with different things that they think should be top of the manifesto. This is meant to show that cabinet does have a say, because you contrast this to 2017, where, as has been documented in The Spectator, a lot of ministers didn't actually really know what was in the manifesto until they were on the bus to the launch. And this is the sense that actually, if you look too at the ministers who are involved, it does align pretty closely to the key areas that the party wants to push in a general election. So Priti Patel, I mean, great office of state, so you would expect her to be there, but Home Office, big focus on law of order. Gavin Williamson, education, big push there. Matt Hancock, health, big push there. Liz Truss, international trade. But I think that's also perhaps because she has carved out a niche for herself as a voice of freedom in the Conservative Party. And you saw in Boris Johnson's leadership campaign how some of the things he was pushing for seemed to be things that she might have had a hand in. So this idea of getting rid of stealth taxes. Are we going to see something on sugar tax in the manifesto? So you have that group and Michael Gove too, all coming together and just starting to feed their ideas in. But I don't know how long the manifesto is going to be. I think James has some thoughts on that.
I think the manifesto will be short, but I think one of the interesting things about it is, I mean, there's another example of how Brexit defines everything. They always need to prepare two different manifestos. If they are fighting an election in an extension with a kind of get Brexit done mantra, their target voters are very much the voters they were aiming for at Tory conference. So it's, you know, they are people who traditionally might have voted Labour or certainly in Labour-leaning areas, which voted Leave. So you're looking at big policies on the NHS, vocational education, raising the minimum wage. But if you've got a Brexit deal through and done, you're much more trying to see off the Lib Dems. You're trying to put together an electoral coalition that looks much more like 2015 in terms of how you win this thing. You emphasise the economic risks of Jeremy Corbyn, you know, how high are taxes. You go out, you're emphasising your environmental credentials and all this stuff. So I think it is very difficult for them to work out how they what they want to emphasise in the manifesto until they know the circumstances under which they're fighting the election.
And James, we got a sneak peek into what they think that election will look like today. The BBC has reported on a leaked Tory election leaflet, which is anti-Brexit party. Tell us what it says.
It is just a classic. This is presuming the election is fought during an extension with Brexit not being, in inverted commas, done. It's a classic squeeze message. It's Nigel Farage can't deliver Brexit. Voting for him only leads to a hung parliament and more diva and delay. It's a very good story for the BBC to get hold of. Everyone would have liked to get hold of its leaflet, but it is an entirely predictable squeeze message. One of the things that the Tories will try and do is try and turn this election into a forced choice. They will try and say to Brexit Party voters, so do you want Boris Johnson or Jeremy Corbyn as Prime Minister? Do you want a Conservative government or a Remain Alliance government? They're going to try and force those questions down people's throats because, you know, for obvious reasons, most Brexit Party voters would rather have a Boris Johnson government than a Remain Alliance government. And so they will try and make them think that voting Brexit Party is a wasted vote.
Katie and James, thanks very much. And you can subscribe to this podcast, Coffee House Shots, through all the usual routes. And have you heard of Spectator Radio? It's a selection of some of our best podcasts, a different one released every day. We have podcasts on religion, culture, literature, and much, much more. Just go to spectator.co.uk/radio to find out more. And if you enjoy our podcast, why not join Sam Leith on the 23rd of October for an interview with Robert Harris? They'll be speaking in Westminster about Robert Harris's latest book. For more details on that, go to spectator.co.uk/Harris. Thanks for listening and join us again tomorrow.
Thanks to our sponsor, More Than a Number, the new podcast from ICAEW. Hear presenter Louise Cooper in discussion with thought leaders, unpacking the numbers behind some of the most pertinent questions of our time. Are businesses ill-prepared to cope with climate change? Is workplace inequality inevitable? And do businesses really have an age problem? Simply search for More Than a Number in your podcast app to download now.